We made this.
Welcome to The Time Is Now, a Millennium Podcast. Soylent Green is people. I'm your host, Darren Mooney, and joining me is...
Christopher Knowles.
Hi, Chris. How are things?
Very good. How are things on your side of the pond?
little hectic, little frantic. That sort of midsummer sort of rush going on. And actually, this is a sort of a perfect sort of bit of confusion here as well. We're going to be talking today about Walkabout, which kind of maybe fits just a little bit about this sort of disorientation, being a little bit disjointed, a little bit chaotic, and a little bit disordered. So if that happens, remember, listeners, it is entirely planned. And entirely in fitting with what we're trying to do here. So we're talking about Walkabout, which is the 17th episode of the first season, directed by Cliff Bowle, written by Chip Johannesson, his third script for the series, following on from Blood Relatives and Force Majeure, and co-written with Tim Tankosik. And let's jump into sort of the discussion of the episode. So we start normally by ranking the episode out of 10. So Chris, for yourself, how would you rank Walkabout?
Oh, I'd give this a solid 8.
Nice. I would probably be in a sort of like a 7.5, probably an 8 as well. What is it about it that sort of like that screams for that kind of higher rating, that sort of marks it on your... Like, do you grade the first season on a curve? Or like, you know, is it sort of... How would this sort of rank in terms of your first season of Millennium? Would this be up there?
Yeah, I think this is pretty up there. And the thing that I like is that it breaks the pattern. It breaks sort of the schema that we'd been used to with the serial killers of the week. It offers us a deeper look into Frank and his psychology and his motivation. And I think it also ties in very well to an ongoing crisis in, you know, at least in American society, which is, you know, over medication, misprescriptions, the overuse of psychoactive pharmaceuticals, you know, and the use of, you know, these drugs as, you know, as a means of social control. So I think there are a lot of things going on here that really expand the Millennium palette in very interesting ways.
Yeah, and it arguably has even got kind of more relevance since it aired, like a lot of Millennium, I think we'd argue, in terms of stuff like we're a lot more wary now, I think, than we were in like 1997 about things like the pharmaceutical industry and stuff like that and the control that it has and the use of prescription. I mean, the overprescription. In this episode, we're talking about antidepressants. We're talking about, as you pointed out, psychotic medication. But in terms of in the United States and stuff like that, there's been a lot of discussion, justly as well, about overprescription of other types of medication at the behest of the industry as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's become a huge news story. I mean, we have people getting arrested. You have all these pharmaceutical companies that were resorting to all kinds of very nefarious and underhanded and, you know, frankly, illegal means to get people addicted to opioids. And we've had several thousands of deaths because of opioid overdose. And this was not street level drugs. This wasn't, urban pushers and so on and the old bromides. This was
your local doctor writing you a prescription. Yeah.
Yeah. This was white collar crime at its most destructive and nefarious, I think.
Yeah. And it's kind of amazing to see, again, Millennium touching that. And I think you're entirely right. One of the reasons why I love it so much is that I think you've described it as expanding the palette. And it kind of does that to a great deal. It kind of pushes out the idea of what crime is and kind of what Frank does to a certain extent, even in the case that he's investigating. And even within that, I think Walkabout isn't necessarily about the case per se. It's very similar. Again, Johannesson did something similar with Blood Relatives, where he took the standard format of the serial killer of the week and then sort of like expanded it outwards and sort of built an interesting story around that framework, where he was less interested in the murderer than he was in like the subject of his study. And with Walkabout here, you have a similar thing happening, except instead of like building outward from a standard serial killer of the week, he's building outward from a story that is itself very different and very unique in kind of to what Millennium has been to this point. And I agree, I absolutely love it. Out of curiosity, what do we think that Walkabout scored on IMDb? Like, looking at sort of the Millennium first season.
Oh, it's so hard for me to judge. I mean, those grades are all over the place. I would say like a 7.2 or some. I would say somewhere in the 7 range, maybe 7.7.
You're pretty close the first time there. You got a 7.4 with 213 votes or 215 votes. Which again, it's kind of interesting because it does showcase how much Millennium is sort of the younger brother of the X-Files. Because if you look at
it's the redheaded stepchild. It's the redheaded stepchild of the X-Files. I mean, it's interesting because it's held in high regard by sort of a core fan base. But I think, you know, sort of the people who might be lurking around IMDb don't necessarily go for it. You know, it's the old divide, you know, in the sort of the 10-13 audience as a whole, or you have, you know, people who gravitate towards the pulpier sort of drive-in movie aspects of it, and then, you know, a smaller, more dedicated or maybe educated core that go for more for the, you know, the more thought-provoking, the more adult kind of material. And I think that, you know, IMDb is notorious for being a fanboy haven. And there's actually been some comment and a lot of articles written about how, you know, how distorting the effect can be. And interestingly enough, I mean, you know, they closed down. IMDb used to have message boards that really became cesspits of the worst corners of toxic fandom. I think that when Amazon bought it out, that their first order of business was to shut them down.
Burn it down. Burn it all. Disinfect it. Wipe the servers. There will be no record of this. Yeah. Scorch the earth.
Yeah,
salt
exactly.
It as well.
Salt the fields. Yeah.
Because I was actually thinking about this when I saw, because that's a that 215 votes is a relatively small number compared to stuff that, you know, the X-Cast is our sister podcast, we've both done it, and we've both done the Guess the Score game, and the Guess the Score game is always like, with 2,000 votes. So like, I'm looking at the fourth season of the X-Files, which is running concurrently, and all of its votes are getting like, all of its episodes are getting, you know, multiples of 10 times more votes. So, you know, 2,450 votes on Tempest Fugit, which was the, you know, 17th episode of the fourth season, which may not be entirely comparable because that's a big mythology episode. But even if you look at, say, standalone episodes, you're looking at around the range of 2,200 at this stage in the run of the show. So it's kind of interesting how it kind of gives you a sense of how cult sort of Millennium is, that like its first season is attracting, you know, 215 voters out of the entire user base on the site.
I think with Millennium, it's interesting because I think that if you look at the arc, you know, it started off extremely strong in the ratings and then it just kind of cratered. I think that Millennium was kept on the air basically to keep Chris Carter happy. And then when, what's his name, Doug Herzog came in and didn't care about keeping Chris Carter happy at all, you know, that's sort of like sealed the show's fate. I think that it was always kind of like, well, you know, we're making hundreds of billions of dollars or however much money off the X-Files. We got to, you know, if this guy wants to keep this weird, very confrontational and polarizing
abrasive
show, abrasive and polarizing show in the air, you know, we'll let him get away with it. And I think it's sort of a testament to the fact that, you know, towards the end of the sixth season that the ratings really began to sort of soften on the X-Files, and its moment had sort of passed, you know, that its moment in the cultural spotlight. I mean, because it burned so hot in the fifth season. I mean, X-Files was just ubiquitous everywhere you possibly looked. And I think that was almost like a burnout. You know, it was kind of like a, you know, the candle burned itself out. And it's inevitable, I think, especially with genre shows. Genre shows have a very interesting arc that they don't, you know, they very rarely maintain a large audience the longer you go on. I mean, one of the examples that I always cite was Star Trek The Next Generation, which is, you know, a very highly regarded show by so many different people. But, you know, people don't realize that show lost, you know, in aggregate over a million viewers in its last season. So it's just the nature of the beast.
I mean, it's also like it's much more pronounced even if you look at the spin-offs from The Next Generation, because The Next Generation, you point out, peaked in, say, its fifth or sixth season, which was when the executives greenlit all of the spin-offs, you know? So you have Deep Space Nine, you have Voyager, and they're their ratings trajectory is downwards, and consistently downwards, with the spin-offs until you reach sort of cancellation point where they would be dying to have those 1 million people back. Now, obviously, there are other factors there, like airing on UPN and stuff like that, which is not accessible everywhere in the States. But genre, I think you're entirely right. Genre shows, particularly as they run long, tend to bleed viewers. And I think that you're right that the X-Files sort of at that point has sort of waned. And I think that there is maybe something interesting there in the idea that, like, Millennium's cancellation was not so much a reflection of its own performance, even, as a reflection of kind of other forces as well. Because you point out Herzog, who arrived, and to a certain extent, it's from what I gather, and you probably have a much better read on this than I do, but there seemed to be very much a power play in an operation there, where Herzog felt that he was coming in and he was making his mark on Fox, and Carter was seen as like an old guard, sort of establishment figure. And Herzog had this bold new vision for the future that was going to be youth-oriented and sort of hip and with it. And, you know, Carter was very much not part of that. And to a certain extent, as I understand it, and again, this may be based on interviews with other people as well, Herzog's approach was very much like a flexing. It was a, I'm in charge now. I'm bringing everybody and putting them in their place.
Yeah, well, yeah, I think that's very much true. And I think, you know, because Herzog came over from Comedy Central, and his whole agenda was to turn Fox into a half-hour comedy, you know, skewing young network. And it's, I think the only thing that survived, you know, its first season or its first half season was Malcolm in the Middle, and everything else is absolutely crazy.
Died. Yeah.
And this is just a little aside, but one of his pet projects was a series called Action.
With Jay Mohr, right? Yes.
Yeah, with Jay Mohr. And
is it Alana Douglas was the other actor in there with him, if I remember
Alana
correctly?
Douglas, yes. And Buddy Hackett. I mean, it's a very funny and very canny kind of knowing inside baseball show. But I can't help to, you know, if you look carefully through that show, I can't help to think that, you know, Doug Herzog was handing the writers notes, you know, airing his grievances with Chris Carter throughout the series. You know, one of the main elements that I would cite is that, you know, that the pilot of Action deals with this a flop film called Slow Death, you know, so this military horror movie. And I can't help but see the parallels between Slow Death and Harsh Realm, you know, so.
Which Herzog, again, famously cancelled almost immediately on taking the reins. And again, yeah, one of the few cases where Carter has been openly petty in interviews, not even like kind of casting subtle shade. Whereas when Herzog was fired, you know, you can read interviews on Eat the Corn where Carter's like, well, you know, the guy who cancelled my show got cancelled himself, so I'm still here. Which is a very...
I think Harsh Realm was a horrible show, so I can't really... I think the whole thing was just misbegotten from beginning to end. And if you look sort of at the backstage drama that was going on at the time in 10-13, you really wonder how anything got written, because everything was just so strife-riven and fraught, and there was just so much drama and conflict. You know, how could you have possibly written anything decent? And it's interesting because the seventh season of The X-Files, you know, for a while, I can't necessarily explain it, but it was one of my favorite seasons. And I sort of look back on it now. I'm like, why did I think that? But it's just, you know, things exist for the time. And one of the things that I should say, and, you know, I think applies to Millennium, is that, you know, these shows are meant to be watched once, maybe twice. You know, they're not meant to be poured over and discussed ad nauseum 20 years later. So I think that, you know, it very much fit with the time. And I think one of the problems with Millennium is that it never really found a way to tap into that zeitgeist in a way that was appealing. I mean, I think it tapped into the zeitgeist, you know, in particular this episode we're discussing now. I mean, but, you know, as you've mentioned, and I think a lot of other people mentioned, you know, Millennium was kind of ahead of the curve in some ways. It was sort of anticipating trends that would sort of metastasize further on down the line, and people just didn't recognize them as such. Because, I mean, let's look at that time. I mean, I don't know what it was like in Ireland. Well, I know what it was like in Ireland. That was the Celtic Tiger era, right? Yeah. I mean, things were just hopping. I mean, you know, it was like, you know, sort of swinging London, swinging Britain, part two. You know, you had...
Rule Britannia, or Cool Britannia, actually, Cool, I think it was as well.
I mean, things were just, you know... Everything was coming up roses, and I don't think the sort of the darkness and the pessimism that we saw in Millennium really kind of fit the mood of the times, you know. So I think that in that regard, it's perfectly understandable why at this point in time, you'd only have 200 people commenting on an IMDb page. So
let's kind of move into talking about Walkabout, because Walkabout is a very strange episode of television in general, but of Millennium in particular. And we talked a little bit about this when we got to, we talked about The Thin White Line. And it's kind of like interesting how in the second half of the first season of Millennium, you start seeing a real conscious shift in the kind of stories that the show can tell. I mean, we've joked before and we will joke again about like the serial killer of the week format and how sustainable that was as a model for like 24 episodes of a year or whatever, even 22 episodes a year. But like one of the things that's interesting when you get to this back half of Millennium is that you start seeing the show sort of experimenting with the kind of stories that it can tell. So I'm thinking, like, for example, of, you know, Sacrament, which is the one where Frank's niece is kidnapped, his sister-in-law.
Exactly,
And then you have Covenant as well, which is the episode that airs directly before this, which is about family annihilation, which is an entirely different sort of profiling, where they have the suspect captured already, who's admitted his guilt, and Frank is being brought in to work a profile after that on a really grim, really harrowing case, but it's very different from any other story to that point in the season. Later on, you'll have things like, you know, Lamentation, Paris, Mortality, Stone Dominion, which completely change what's going on, but even things like Broken World, which is about an emerging serial killer. I mean, I don't think the execution on that's particularly good, but it's a sense of, like, it's getting past the, well, we're tracking down a serial killer. And then Moranum, again, this is the Johannesson sort of final script of the season, which is Marananatha, that sounds like a really awful Bananarama single. That sort of episode looking at Russia and stuff like that, and the Antichrist, and these sort of religious themes as well, which feels very much outside of what the first half of the season really looked like. And Walkabout's a large part of that, because the opening scene is absolutely striking. It's a scene of it's not entirely clear what's going on immediately. There's this wonderful atmospheric, and Cliff Bohl, who directed like a handful of episodes of this in The X-Files, primarily I would know him from Star Trek, where he directed like The Best of Both Worlds, the wonderful sort of Patrick Stewart.
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh. I am Locutus.
Your life as it has been is over. Resistance is futile. Was it So Long Number One or something like that is the line. But yeah, that sort of epic cliffhanger. Mr. Worf, fire. Dun-dun, dun-dun, dun-dun. So Cliff Bohl kind of gives us this really atmospheric sort of opening where you have the dog outside and it's kind of scratching at the door, and then this wonderful horror movie sort of slow pan through this abandoned space, but sort of pressing down a corridor as you start hearing noise brewing and something horrible's happening, but you can't see it. You don't know what it is. And you see like this nurse coming out with a bloody nose. This is a horror movie shot. It's not like it's not a serial killer movie. It's almost a zombie movie shot. It's a hand trying to grab her through the door as she's trying to shut it, panicking and sort of stressing. And then like inside the room, you get these horrific quick sort of psychedelic shots of people doing all sorts of things, you know, without context for them. And then you see somebody beating on the door, smashing on the door, and it's Frank. And this is breathtaking. This is probably, I think, is this my favorite teaser of the first season? But I think it might be by a significant distance. What about yourself?
Yeah, it's great. And it reminds me in a strange way of Jacob's Ladder. Some of the scenes in Jacob's Ladder, you know, even though sort of the it's repositioned as far as what we're actually looking at. And it's interesting how we later see a lot of the people involved in that scene being rather blasé and nonchalant about what they experience. I the one thing that I would kind of point out is I think the premise of this episode is very classic noir.
It's a lost weekend, basically.
It's very much, but it also reminds me of sort of like neo noir, like Dark City. You know, you wake up and you don't know what happened. You don't.
Memento, yeah, as well.
Yeah, exactly. It's very. I think it's can be looked at as a very classic example of neo-noir at its finest, and neo-noir sort of wedded to I would say maybe more of an X-Files kind of premise. I mean, I think that the whole thing with drug testing and things like that, it's what we're looking at is human experimentation, which goes back to the very first scene of the very first episode of the X-Files. So I mean, we're looking at something that is drifting into that neighborhood, but it's also, if you look at this episode, I mean, I never really spoken to Chip Johannesson. I don't know exactly what he was referencing here, but it feels very much like the case studies that you read about MKUltra, you know, how people are sort of dosed in these trials without their, and all these horrible things happen. And it's interesting too, because the premise of Walkabout is basically rewritten for the X-Files later on this year. I mean, not too long after this episode aired, we see a very similar premise with demons. Which
I was actually about to ask that, yeah.
Yeah, which is more explicitly about MKUltra. But I think that, it's a very interesting... I think Chip Johannesson was really the sleeper star here. He was sort of like the cult star here, because the stuff he wrote was so atypical in context of the rest of the series, but it's so damn interesting. It's so thought-provoking, and it's so... It gets under your skin and really sticks with you. There's a real quality to his stories here that, you know, I can see why Carter put him in charge of this show later on in the series run, because I think he has a very fascinating and I would dare say almost like a mystical sensibility that I think really served, you know, this series very well. I mean, we've both, you know, we've spoken off the air about Force Majeure just being like this, like, what did I just watch? You know, it's just like this, it's almost like an assault, you know, it's so bizarre and strange and dreamlike, I think, in a sense. So I think that kind of dreaminess that I think characterizes so many of his Millennium scripts really serves him well here, you know, in the context here of being a nightmare. So, you know, this, we're going to be seeing so much tie in with X-Files as we discuss this episode, but I think it does so in the best way. And I really wish that, he had written, for the X-Files. I know he's credited with Horizon, but, that's sort of like one of these, Writers Guild legalisms, you know, that actually, yeah, that wasn't actually his script. He had this premise about a man who could sort of stop time. And it was basically rewritten very heavily by, you know, Carter's little crew in the X-Files writer's room. So,
yeah, I kind of, part of me suspects that, like, the element of Orison that came most directly from Johannesson was the idea of the space inside your man's head, the trepanning, which, because that's very similar to something he does in the third season of Millennium as well. Now, I know, obviously, demons in the fourth season of X-Files does as well. I want to talk to you about that, because I think one of the things that's most striking and kind of really struck me on rewatch this particular time, because it had been ages since I watched Walkabout. Now, I'd always had a huge soft spot for it, but as I pointed out, the first season of Millennium is pretty heavy. I don't rewatch it that often, because, I mean, when I do rewatch it, I tend to have nightmares, and I can't single them down to particular episodes, but it's this heaviness. We talked about this on the podcast. I think when we were talking about, like, Thin White Line, is this sort of weightiness that it has that weighs on you when you're watching it. So this was my first time rewatching Walkabout in a while, and I was thinking actually specifically about some of the stuff that you'd observed and you've written about, which is this recurring motif that happens, and it happens in the X-Files a lot, actually. And it's kind of interesting that you see Johannesson, who, as you pointed out, is not an X-Files writer, kind of dovetailing it into Millennium. Now, obviously, you know, Carter was showrunner and would have been guiding it, but it is this idea of, as you pointed out, psychedelia. Because I think you're the writer or critic who made the observation that from pretty much the third season onwards of the X-Files, every season has, like, a penultimate episode. And, you know, if it's a two-part season finale, it's, you know, it's an anti-penultimate episode. But one that deals with this idea of, like, changing psychotic perception. So, you know, obviously, Demons is one example in the fourth season of The X-Files, but even things like Scully's Breakdown in Wet Wired, Field Trip in the sixth season, Folie à Deux in the fifth season, that sort of stuff happening. And it's kind of interesting to see that bleeding over into Millennium, even if it's not a direct crossover, even if it's not like, you know, Mulder and Scully being passed in the halls of Quantico or something like that. It's an interesting sort of thematic intersection, I think, between the two.
I got to go back to, like, really wondering what Carter's thinking is. You know, what's his meta narrative? Because I can't help but think that there's something else, you know, there's another story he's trying to tell, you know, besides the story. So, you know, meta in its, you know, in its official definition, basically, there's something he's trying to tell that sort of runs parallel. And I'm not exactly sure what it is. And of course, he will never, ever tell us. Yeah. So I think that, you know, the fact that it's bleeding over into Millennium in this way, and that, you know, Millennium obviously exists in the same universe, even though that wasn't necessarily apparent to it at this time, you know, I really would love to just I don't know, give him sodium pentothal
and,
you know,
and ask what's going on.
Because the thing that we also need to understand too is that, you know, one of the things that fans don't really take into account and probably wouldn't care about, a lot of them wouldn't care about either way, is that, you know, he's working from a completely different data set than all the rest of us, you know, particularly by this point when he's really tied in with a lot of these people in law enforcement and intelligence, you know. I mean, the most obvious example clearly being the Academy group. So I'm not exactly sure what he's trying to say. I just know that he's clearly saying something. I know that sounds, you know, terribly not authoritative on my half, but it's just like, you know, he's trying to say something that transcends the on-screen narrative, but I still have not figured out what that is exactly. I mean, I have an idea, I have a hunch, and I think this particular episode is very much a big step in a certain direction, but like I said, I'm not exactly sure yet.
And obviously, we don't really want to throw ideas out there, cast aspersions or anything like that. What's interesting, though, about this opening scene, and not only just how weird it is and how strange it is and how haunting and sort of horror inspired is, it's that shot of Frank Black himself. Because, I mean, obviously, you know, as you point out, that the first season has this kind of meta narrative of things with the Polaroid stalker and the photos that are being sent to Frank and the idea that Frank is being specifically targeted by something. So there is an element of Frank being kind of drawn into cases. And even you could argue in like episodes, the preoccupation with the violation of the family home, in episodes like Weeds and Wide Open, there's this thematic relevance to what's happening in Frank's life. But that said, what's striking about Walkabout is that immediately from the teaser, it strips away an aspect that kind of we've taken for granted about Millennium, which is the distance between Frank and the case that is literally happening. Now, obviously, you can point to counterexamples along the way, stuff like The Thin White Line, which we discussed, which is about, you know, Frank opening an old case that he was working on, stuff like that. But this is very much, it's very visceral, it's very immediate. It's Frank is the victim. And at several points of the episode, again, you pointed out neo-noir as like a huge influence and kind of overlap kind of thematically and in terms of genre here. Like, not only is Frank the victim of this from the outset, Frank is also a suspect at certain points where Peter is like, and it's very clear Peter isn't accusing him of anything, but Peter's saying, like, just think about the facts of the case. You're saying there's a dead body and you can't remember what happened and there's no other evidence of it and your hands are covered in blood. What conclusion would you draw from those facts? So Walkabout almost immediately removes a level of distance that I think has existed between the audience and Frank Black and kind of the crimes that are being committed or the horror that they're seeing. And I think that's a very striking choice. And it's kind of strange that the show waits until the 17th episode of the first season to do that, perhaps.
Well, you know, one of the things that, you know, with the antagonism, and I don't know if I remembered this wrong or maybe it was implied and not as explicit, but I really got the sense that what the subtext is that Peter is very angry at Frank, not because of he actually suspects him of committing murder.
No, not at all.
But I think he's angry because he thinks that, you know, Frank is undergoing these trials to, you know, basically negate his gift, to sort of pharmaceutically cancel out his insight, you know, the his tools that, you know, that he can't stand to be living in the heads of serial killers, and he can't stand being able to envision these things. And I know that there's always been a lot of back and forth about psychic, and people can sort of point to various quotes that, you know, people have made within the show, but, you know, I think it's pretty clear that it's a psychic gift. And I've always got the sense that the hostility and sort of I think it's very well written and, you know, very well rendered here, particularly, you know, it's like, you know, help me out here, Catherine. You know, it's like, you know, he almost gets the sense that she's resisting, that she, you know, that she might actually know what he's doing, that he's trying to find a drug that will basically give him, a relief from the torments that his gifts, however you choose to define them, offer. One of the disappointments that I would have with this episode is that they back off from that. You know, they sort of, you know, Frank is drugged in the water, which again is a classic MKUltra historical trope. Yeah. I would have liked to have seen, you know, Frank saying, "Yeah, I can't take this anymore." You know, I would have liked to, you know, it, that would have been very humanizing to me. And I think one of the problems with Millennium to the X-Files is that Frank is not, he's a little too, I mean, not traditionally or classically, but there's a little, you know, he doesn't have enough vulnerabilities insofar as what we would describe as like human weaknesses. You know, he suffers and he's made to suffer and he's put through all these torments and trials and tribulations, but there's almost something a little too ennobled about him. I would have liked to have seen, I can't take it anymore. You know, you think you could, you know, do you think you could live with this? You know, you couldn't, you know, and I want to figure out a way to prevent my daughter from having to suffer this. I think that's, you know, I that feels very much like a Carter veto on that plot point, because you always think that somebody like Johansson would go there.
Yeah. And I mean, you could argue that even like in the second season, and again, I know that people are going to sing along with this live and haven't seen the second season, so I'm going to be vague. But the second season, you get a bit of playing around with ideas like that, and the idea of kind of adding a rough edge to Frank. And I guess, like, actually, because I have, like, a list of stuff I want to talk about with this episode, and kind of we're almost not talking about it in sequence, we're just talking about it randomly and kind of in arbitrarily. But that kind of brings me to something that I was kind of thinking about there. This episode adds a bit of an edge to Frank, and in particular, it's one we talked on the podcast before, and we'll probably talk about it again, but the idea that, like, the supporting cast in Millennium, particularly in the first season, was not always particularly well used because there wasn't a lot of internal sort of drama between various characters. And one of the things that Walkabout does really well, and I really appreciate it, is that it gives Frank a bit of an edge. Now, obviously, it's not, as you pointed out, the fact that at the end, it's like, oh, I wasn't trying to get rid of my gift. Why would I get rid of my gift? I'm a human saint. but there is a real kind of edge with Frank where... And you can tell, and again, Lance Henriksen is fantastic in the role, but it's one of the cases, one of the points where Frank gets really angry. Like, there's a moment where, and again, Peter gets really angry as well. And as you point out, there's a real justifiable tension there between them, where you can tell what the two men want, and the two men want different things, even if the episode doesn't set Lunda, that those things being as fundamentally different as the episode would suggest initially, or as you sort of hinted at there. But there's the moment where they're having that argument about, you know, the blood that was found on Frank's hands, and the fact that he remembers somebody dead, and the fact that there's no evidence to back it up, and the fact that he can't remember what he did. Peter is just tired of, like, dealing with Frank like this. There's a real sense of frustration there, and it's interesting, I think, because we've talked about it on the podcast before. I know you and I definitely have, but I've also talked about it with Kurt, and I've talked about it with Tony as well when we're talking about the show. Like, in the first season, there's not really a sense of the characters really seeming like characters, if that makes sense, or having, like, their own unique perspectives or dynamics when they interact with one another. It's a cliche to say that, you know, you need conflict between characters in order to reveal character. You know, that, you know, characters need to be shouting or arguing or melodramatically yelling at one another in order to get a sense of who they are, but it does help to have some sort of underlying tension there that draws the contrast out between them. And I think that Walkabout does that rather well with the character of Peter, where, like, you get a sense of Peter, who is, to this point, Terry O'Quinn, fantastic. You can see why he's a 10-13 regular, but he hasn't really been given much that defines him as a person as distinct from any other member of the Millennium group. He's just the one who appears most and has the most screen presence. I think that with Walkabout and with the conflict with Frank and the frustration he feels at Frank, you get a bit more of him feeling like a person rather than a plot function, if that makes sense.
Well, this is a part of my major problem with at least the early Millennium, and I think it's something that Morgan Wong, you know, tried very hard to address in the second season, and that's just the fact that, you know, the Millennium characters are not terribly interesting. They're not very well developed. They're very hard to differentiate. I mean, Peter's the only one that I can actually call to mind if pressed, and Peter's really not given a lot to do except for walk in and just sort of spout exposition and then walk off. You know, so yeah. I mean, this is really the first kind of sense that I can, you know, imagine in this season that this man has motivations and a personality of his own, other than just to help advance the plot line for Frank. So I think that, you know, the way his character develops throughout the second and third seasons, even though a lot of people thought that, you know, it took sort of this weird wrong turn in the third season, but I would argue that it's entirely consistent if you judge it by the, you know, the standard of POV storytelling. Anyhow, you know, Peter, I appreciate this, and I think it was kind of long overdue in the season that we sort of get a sense that that other characters do other things than just sit around and talk about how great Frank is and how tormented he is. And you know what I mean? It's just, I think that, you know, listen, Millennium is a very fascinating, well-written, well-produced series, but there are some major shortcomings that I think crippled it. And I think one of the things that crippled it is that everything is sort of plot-driven, and the character development, in my opinion, is rather thin and almost like a afterthought in some way.
Yeah, I kind of would almost agree to that to an extent. And it's interesting that around this point in the first season, and it again, like towards the end of the episode, Frank explicitly references the events of and I always get these two confused, but it's Sacrament, isn't it, where his sister-in-law is kidnapped. And he references that as kind of a major impetus for his actions here, because that's the moment at which he began to suspect that Jordan might have the gift as well and it might be passed on. And it makes everything in this episode a bit more personal. And I know that you and I differ in our assessment of the second season. I'm a lot fonder of the second season than you are. But one of the things that I think really worked for me about the second season, and I imagine it's something that, as much as it worked for me, drives other people up the wall, is the sense that it does become a lot more personal. It doesn't feel as abstract or as removed as it could. I mean, even in this episode, you have, I think it's the first time Peter Watts comes inside the house, because famously in the pilot, you know, he meets Frank outside the house because he doesn't want to sully the yellow house by coming into it. And you have, like, Jordan at the end even draws attention to that when she's on the steps of Frank and he's making the kite, and she's like, it's the man who came into the house there a couple of days ago, as if to kind of illustrate that things are getting a little, you know, ironically enough, closer to home. And again, that's going to pay off kind of later in the season with episodes like Lamentation. But it is interesting, and I think it adds a lot to these episodes and to the second half of the first season, is the way in which the characters seem to get drawn into these stories rather than simply like observing them, or as you pointed out, expositing about them. You know,
there's a problem in this episode, and something that you allude to that I think affects the entire 10-13 milieu, and that's that events will happen in episodes and standalone episodes that will inform events and behaviors in following episodes. But I never really, you know, you have to put the pieces together yourself, that they're not going to point this out to you. You know, it's always a sense of like, well, the viewer has to do more of the work. And a great example of this is when Mulder sort of gets very snarky with Skinner in Anasazi, where it's just like, you know, another jerk off assignment where I'm expected to do the government's dirty work for it. Now, that's presumably, and a lot of fans have come to the conclusion that that is a reference to F Emasculata, when Mulder and Skinner have this confrontation about the outbreak and cigarette smoking man's involvement in it and so on. So, you know, the general consensus is that when Mulder says that to Skinner, he's referring to that story, you know, in the episode before. But I think that it would have been nice to just have some sort of breezy offhand mention that sort of adds a little bit more connective tissue here. So I think that, you know, in the sense that, you know, we do know that Frank is concerned about Jordan. You know, he'd just been through this really wretched trauma with his sister-in-law being abducted by, you know, a serial killer, a rapist, torturer, all these kind of things. I just feel that it would have been nice to sew these connections up a bit more explicitly. You know, not too explicitly, because, you know, people need to understand that this is like way, way, way before binging and streaming and all that kind of thing. I mean, you never knew what kind of order some sort of syndicated television show is going to show these episodes in.
More than that, even, like, this was, you know, well, I think the X-Files may have been released on VHS in certain cases. You couldn't count on the audience having seen every previous episode, even if it wasn't being preempted by football, or even if it wasn't being bounced around the schedule or anything like that. You know, just as a law of averages, you couldn't assume the audience had seen the last episode or the last four episodes. And as a kind of a TV writer working for primetime television, your job was to make your show as accessible as possible week on week, including to people who had not seen anything before the episode in question. Yeah, it's something that I don't think people give enough credit to the writers for having to do. I understand the long-term frustration of fans who want that connective tissue and who want that sort of like level of kind of serial storytelling. And I'm really glad that we live in the era where we can do that now. But I do understand it when we go back and we look at TV from like the 90s and you know, that sort of era as well.
Even given that, you know, there could have been a way to do it artfully and do it for somebody who is just dropping in and watching this episode without having any knowledge of this series at all. So, you know, I feel like the connective tissue is implied and would be something that, you know, if you're binging on DVDs or, you know, on some sort of streaming service, you would get that sense. But I think that there's it's a shortcoming. I really do feel it's a shortcoming. I mean, I understand why it exists, but I think that one of the problems, besides the fact that there's so much emphasis on plot and so little emphasis on genuine character development in this season, that I think that, you know, this entire exegesis of the millennium and millennium causing people to go psychotic and do all these horrible things, that was never, for me personally, that was never really made manifestly clear. And I don't think it certainly was made manifestly clear for a casual or an occasional viewer.
I mean, I'll be the first to concede I have a soft spot for the kind of weird existential but unconnected dread that runs through the season. The sense of that quote from the Second Coming by W.B. Yeats, the center cannot hold, but without any sense of like why or how or that the events being connected, just a general sense of dread. But I also understand that that's exhausting of itself and frustrating as a viewer. And even when I was watching it for the first time, incredibly frustrating waiting for that to sort of come together. That's interesting though that you mentioned kind of plot driven and stuff like that, because this is one of the things that I have a huge soft spot for when it comes to Walkabout, when it comes to this episode in particular, is the fact that its plot is actually relatively light. It's not particularly like concerned with like the nuts and bolts of the mystery. We talked, I think, when we talked about like the Thin White Line, we talked about the frustration with doing the serial killer of the week after week after week. And one of the things that Johannesson does here, and he did it in Blood Relatives as well, he did in Force Majeure, and he doesn't get enough credit for, is finding ways to kind of shake up the template of the serial killer of the week. So it's not just some guy hunting women and tying them down and torturing them and shooting it, you know, in a dark basement with knives and Oblake Angles, and having him like quote scripture or poetry in a way that's ominous and unsettling. What Johannesson does is he's one of the writers in the first season who actually takes advantage of like the range of possibilities that exist within the show. And this is a very interesting case because it's not a serial killer of the week. You know, it's not. And in fact, actually the one murder that he commits by his own hands, which is the nurse, is described as being unpremeditated. You know, it's described as something that he wasn't planning to do. He also murders Danny later on, but he does that in a very unconventional manner by drugging him and releasing him into traffic. And it's kind of, it's an interesting dynamic within the episode, I think.
I think that if you took Chris Carter's episodes and took Chip Johannesson's episodes and isolated them from the whole, you'd be looking at a much different series. And I think, you know, possibly a much more interesting one. And I wouldn't want to say cohesive, but you get this sense if you watch just those, I guess, probably be like 8 episodes in total, that you're watching a much different series than if you included Loin like a Hunting Flame and Wide Open and so on and so forth and
Weeds and
Kingdom
yes,
Come yeah. and Weeds and you know and just this whole string of really depressing and not, you know, sort of monotonous episodes. So you're looking at a much more different series that seems to, I think, communicate that sort of millennial existential horror and dread that the show had purported to present. You know, I think that those serial killers, if you ask most casual viewers, you know, from 1996 who checked in for a few episodes and then turned off, I mean, you know, that's where that whole serial killer of the week, you know, all it is just one, you know, monotonous serial killer narrative. And I don't think that's necessarily accurate, but that's just the impression that it left. And impressions in television and pop culture are kind of everything. So Chip Johannesson and Carter and, you know, a few others here and there, if you it creates the impression that you're looking at an entirely different series than all the others that dilute the mix. And I think that's one of the reasons why this episode is so interesting to me, is that it doesn't feel at all like a serial killer. Well, I mean, it's, you know, objectively not a serial killer. It's somebody who's planning a mass murder, but, you know, he's more of a fanatic and an ideologue driven by, you know, this powerful sense of, you know, the collapse of society and, you know, something needs to be done to shake it out of its stupor and all these kind of things. So he's not, you know, he's not one of these characters that we just got so tired of earlier in the run.
Yeah. And in fact, the episode makes a point to almost minimize him to a certain extent. He's played by Gregory Itzam, and his name is like Hans Ingram. But he's only really in a single scene. He appears a couple of times throughout. You get a couple of short scenes with him. You get like a bit of dialogue when he goes to visit Danny, you know, in his little sort of rundown apartment. But you don't really get a sense of the episode focusing on him, to the point where, like, when Frank shows up at the office where everything's gone completely crazy and he, you know, he's let himself into the security office, he feels like Ingram's about to let this big speech. He's about to have this big, meaningful speech about, like, his philosophical motivations. And, like, Frank is just not having any of it because that's not really what Frank is concerned about at that moment in time. And I kind of like that aspect of the episode, that it minimizes it. I think it's also an interesting thing to do in a serial killer show, to sort of get at the, because it reminds me a lot of, is it the Tylenol poisoning in Chicago in the 80s? There's a similar sort of spate of things where...
Tylenol? Like
Tylenol, yes, sorry, that's the one, yes. Sorry, non-American. yeah, and it's kind of an interesting thing to do in the framework of a show like this. And it, like, if you are going to do this sort of, like, mass murder or attempted mass murder, it's an interesting... You know, it's you're right, it's more than just the you know, salacious kind of like serial killer hunting their victim through the woods sort of aspect, or kind of Silence of Lambs ripoff or Seven ripoff that we've been seeing, or not that we've been seeing, that's unfair to the show, but that defines a lot of the first half of the first season outside of the episodes written by Carter and arguably Wong and Morgan as well.
Well, I'll tell you, you know, referring to this character, and what's his name again?
Hans Ingram. Yeah, he's so,
Hans Ingram,
so,
yeah.
So marginalized, yeah, that we...
Which is like such one of those strange... you know, sort of only a character on a 1013 show would have a name like that. And I'm going to totally botch the name here, but Zelko Ivanik,
you know,
a very, very, very fine actor who had appeared in an extraordinarily mediocre first season.
Roland.
X-Files.
Yeah.
Yes, Roland. Which, of course, I mean, I loved every episode of the first season of the X-Files passionately, because that's the way it was back in the day. But anyhow, yeah, like I got the sense that it was almost like a committee, some sort of nefarious syndicate kind of group that was orchestrating this. And then when it turned out to be just this like guy, when he shows up, I'm like, wait, it's just him? Who is he? Why is, you know, it's just like, it was so weird to me, because I don't want to say that they didn't present it properly, but I guess just in the context of TV tropes and these stereotypes and conventions that we're so used to in television, I really expected to be some sort of mustache twirling syndicate kind of group in a sterile boardroom, you know, plotting this kind of mass hysteria and for some nefarious reasons or whatever. The fact that, and again, I'm going to admit that this is entirely my fault, my mistake, so on and so forth. But it just seemed like so odd to me that it would just be this, like, just this one guy, you know, who was doing this. And it kind of reminds me in a weird way that Sense and Anti-Sense, the second season episode, almost kind of reverse that equation, you know, in a very strange way. And I believe that's also Johannesson. So you can tell that there are through lines of thought that sort of animate his writing that are almost distinct from the overall, you know, narratives that are being woven through the first and second season of the series. You know, Johannesson almost seems to be like you know, a writer's room unto himself, sort of exploring his own ideas, his own obsessions, his own concerns. And that's why I think it really kind of threw me off. And again, I will admit that that is entirely my misconception, but that's just the way. I mean, I would just be curious if anybody feels the same way that I do.
Yeah, there's an interesting, like, I mean, we'll probably come back to Johannesson there, because I think there's a lot of interesting stuff in terms of what interests him and what motivates him as a writer and how this sort of fits with, like, his overall work on the show and kind of in general. But and when you talk about, like, the idea of it being just one guy, it is an interesting dynamic, particularly in the context of this episode, because there is a bit of a push and pull, and I think it's a push and pull that you frequently see in television and in media and in film as well, when you're doing narratives about, say, the pharmaceutical industry and things like that. Where you have this tension between the idea of the industry itself and possibly being hostile, but also the tendency within these sorts of narratives to pull back from that. And like, I again, it's a tough tightrope to walk, where you have like the medications that are vitally essential to people. And you don't want to, last thing that you want to do when you're writing an episode like this is fuel conspiracy theory that prevents people from taking medication that will help them or that they need. Because, you know, you play into myths about how these medications affect you. And I like that the episode goes out of its way to have, while Ingram is kind of a radical and while the drug trial gets out of control, there's this interesting element where it makes a point that, say, Danny, the doctor, is actually helping people by getting them into these drug trials, even though there's a sense of disdain for the human guinea pigs and the exploitation of them and things like that. I don't think the episode comes down hard on one side or the other, and it's kind of hard to unpack what it is saying about pharmaceuticals in general, I think. Because it's very clear Ingram is motivated by an anti-pharmaceutical company sort of agenda. He wants to, you know, he's talking about how they drug people and they lure them into stupors and how he's helping them wake up and all this sort of stuff. But the episode isn't really interested in that per se, I think.
One of the problems that I personally have when dealing with these topics is that it's always presented as a binary, and you know, it's like Coke, Pepsi. You're always sort of forced
one side
into
or the
these,
other.
Yeah, to choose one side or the other, and it's much more complex than that. For instance, you know, we hear a lot about anti-vax and vaccination and stuff. I mean, the impetus originally behind vaccination was about contaminants and corporate negligence. Do you know what I'm saying? It wasn't like, oh, all vaccinations are horrible, don't take vaccinations. The original, I remember this because I remember when this first arose, it was like, why are they putting, you know, thimerosal, which contains mercury, in the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine? Why, you know, it doesn't belong in there. What's it there for? I mean, there was a lot of concerns, like, what are they injecting into us? Like, are they just sort of cutting corners and doctoring and contaminating these vaccinations? And then what it became was like, oh, are you pro-vax or anti-vax? Well, that's not really the issue, but that's the way it tends to get boiled down. And it tends to get boiled down by, you know, these very large public relations firms that have banks of trolls and bots and things like that to manipulate people's opinions online. And I think with the SSRIs, which I think, yeah, Zoloft, no, it's Proloft.
Proloft, yeah. It's.
Let's put this in context. You know, let's dial back the clock a bit here, is that this is the Prozac Nation era. There was a book, a woman whose name is escaping me at the moment, who wrote a book called Prozac Nation. And Prozac was, you know, that was kind of the story. It was a little bit earlier in the decade, but it was really kind of a story at the time. But there's also a major issue here that a lot of scientific studies, and this is very controversial, but a lot of, you know, peer-reviewed scientific studies have concluded that SSRIs, of which this Proloft would presumably be, a family member of, are not actually effective and only have a placebo effect kind of efficacy. And there's been a lot of problems with side effects and things like that. So it's a very difficult and thorny issue. You can't reduce it to a binary, as this character is obviously doing in this episode. But it's you know, there are a lot of legitimate, documented, peer-reviewed scientific concerns about these medications, and especially with the long-term use of these medications. And there's also the ever-present concern about major pharmaceutical companies who have all the money and power in the world to overprescribe these medications, to prescribe these medications to people who don't need them, to misprescribe these medications. You know, we're seeing now in this country, I don't know what it's like in Ireland, but we're seeing a number of states' attorney generals filing major class action lawsuits against the pharmaceutical industry over opioids.
Yeah.
That the pharmaceutical companies create a lot of front groups, like the American Pain Association or something like that. I don't remember the name exactly, that would go on all these talk shows and just shill for these companies. And a lot, you know, people are getting, like, they're actually getting arrested. And we've had tens of thousands of deaths from overdose because of, you know, the overprescription of these medications. So, you know, people who have major injuries or cancer or, you know, acute use for opioids is entirely legitimate and needed and necessary. But they were sort of creating this family of symptoms to justify
prescribing and
the overprescription.
Selling,
yeah. And I'll tell you something, you know, I was being treated for, I was actually being mistreated. I was, you know, I was misdiagnosed for, a pain condition that I have that's actually just an inflammatory pain condition. But the problem was is that I was not responding to the normal anti-inflammatories. So, I mean, I spent more than a decade of my life basically being a guinea pig for all these medications. And, you know, some of the medications, I can't even begin to tell you the reaction I had to them. There was one, you know, they wanted me to take a Parkinson's drug and, I literally felt like I was being poisoned. Like I woke up in the middle of the night with like a strong metallic taste in my mouth, you know, which is a symptom of poisoning. So, I mean, God knows what's going on with these drugs. So, I mean, speaking from experience, long, hard experience, you know, pharmaceutical companies have a profit motive.
Yeah.
First and foremost, and treating and helping relieve symptoms is the secondary consideration. And unfortunately, that profit motive has created untold death and misery and damage in this country. So it's an interesting thing that I don't think you can address properly or solve in a 45-minute detective program, you know?
In terms of Johannesson, to bring it back, there's an interesting sort of like aspect of almost like alchemy and mysticism running through this.
Yeah, you know, mysticism. Like Johannesson has a very mystical bent, which I appreciate. Yeah,
tray panning is like a recurring motif in Johannesson scripts, and I think we talked earlier about like its use in Demon, for example, in the fourth season climax of the X Files. But I like that Johannesson's all like, "Yep, this is exactly where I fit in. Get in where you fit in." But I mean. Here, even you have things like this is about a pharmaceutical company and it's about a drug called Proloft, but it's like it's a weird mystical application of the drug to a certain extent, where you have like the drug itself, but you have the twisted mirror image of the drug, the literal inversion of the drug. And obviously, like in the episode themselves, they talk about the you know, the poison with thalidomide and stuff like that, and you know, as a direct scientific influence. But like within the episode itself, it's quite literally a mirror image. It's described as a mirror image or an evil twin or an anti-Proloft. And it's something that transforms you instead of calming you and soothing you and helping you deal with this sort of like inner problems. It just brings them all bubbling to the surface. And it's kind of, it does have this almost like alchemy, you know, it's not chemistry, it's alchemy to a certain extent, where you have things being sort of transformed and changed. And even at that with people as well. So you have like Daniel Miller, who was top of his class, who was like a doctor who did wonderful work in helping people. And he's been transformed by this, you know, by his own experiences, by what's happened to him, which he can't account for or explain. And I mean, that's the thing with this episode is that like, it's normally about, you know, Frank trying to figure out his gift or trying to figure out if there's a way to help Jordan deal with the gift that she might have inherited. But like, there's a real sense when he's talking with Daniel Miller or Danny Miller about like he doesn't know what this is, he doesn't know what his gift is, what his visions are. You know, there's a moment where he says, you know, where Danny says, I thought I did you a favor, one to another, and Frank's response is, one what to another, because they don't have a word for it. But the idea is that like whatever's happened to Danny has changed him, and he's gone from being, you know, first in his class, like big successful doctor who does lots of charity work, to living in this dingy apartment where he can't afford rent. And he's showing Frank a picture and he's boasting how he's no longer first in his class. He's fourth in his class. He's been literally transformed and changed. But you have this aspect of people being like having this element of themselves brought out. We talked a little about like the hallucinogenic nature of experiences where you have people talking about like, you know, I saw you cut off your own nose, but it's right there on your face, so it doesn't mean it happened. Or Frank's visions. And again, it's telling the episode uses drug trip imagery. And the way that it uses it is very similar to the way that other episodes have presented like Frank's innate ability to see in this series of like quick cuts and distorted imagery and like sort of fisheye lens almost and kind of warped intense close up in a way that uses the same cinematic language as well. It's very kind of weird and trippy and psychedelic and kind of it is mystical in a sense that something's being unlocked, and it suggests that what this stuff is doing, you know, that's and again, I think we alluded to the experiments done by MK Ultra, for example, and stuff like that, because it is the water that was tainted in the waiting room. Frank didn't take the drug voluntarily. He was given the drug because it was in the water that he was drinking. And again, you get that shot at the start where you see the hand crumpling the little cup of water, and that's Frank's hand obviously as well, and that's when everything starts to go wrong. And it's a very out there sort of story to be telling, particularly in the confines of, you know, what is sarcastically or derisively or dismissively referred to as a Serial Killer of the Week show. And I like that oddness. I really, really love that oddness here.
Yeah, well, I want to address Danny because, you know, you brought him up several times, and I think that there's a subtext there that, you know, you've probably seen at university, and I've seen, and I know people who've seen, is that that's the onset of schizophrenia in a person's early 20s. And I feel that if you look at Danny's story and if you look at the arc of his life, it reminds me a lot of people who will have early onset schizophrenia in their 20s are often extraordinarily intelligent, extraordinarily gifted in many ways. And the tragedy of it is that all this promise and all these gifts, you know, are often just completely jettisoned and sabotaged by the disease. And it's much more common than I think a lot of people are willing to admit, because it is so tragic. It's heartbreaking. And to me, when I see Danny, I don't necessarily see somebody who was destroyed by drugs. I see somebody who is probably experimenting a lot with different kinds of medications to deal with his native condition, which would be schizophrenia. And I think that I feel that Ivanek plays him that way. And I feel that is the through line and the implication that we're meant to take away from this. So I see it. Yeah, I just see it in that context, that this is a story about somebody who is the victim, you know, of a very tragic disease that is essentially, it's treatable, but it's incurable.
Yeah.
And I, you know, it's something that we see a lot in, I think, in X-Files episodes. You know, one of the examples that I would cite here, and even though the timeline would be a bit different, was Harold Piller in Closure in the seventh season in the X-Files. You know, somebody who's has this gifts of insight, but also has a disease that he struggles with. But, you know, interestingly enough, I mean, André Breton, the famous French surrealist poet, you know, had always had these sort of rather, you know, crackpot theories about schizophrenia being some sort of gift that allows people to access other realms of existence or consciousness and so on and so forth. And this is actually, unfortunately, a very common belief among, you know, in some quarters, and you know, in many cases, a lot of people who are involved in, you know, drug testing and mind control experiments and things like that. So it's a very thorny and complex issue that, in, you know, again, in that 45-minute format, you can only kind of touch upon. You can only touch upon. But, in this case, I really thought that was one of the better components of this script, is just how much of the complexity of this Danny character that we are able to experience.
Yeah, one of the interesting things about Danny is that he reminds me a lot, and particularly, and it seems to happen more with each viewing, is that, and again, it's something that comes up in 10-13 again and again and again. I don't think it's, I don't know if it's as specific as kind of what you described there with early onset schizophrenia and stuff like that, or if it's intended in that way, or if it's like something that even the writers and staff had kind of like thought about, or the production team had actually sat down and thought about. But he reminds me a lot of figures like Max Fennig in Fallen Angel from the first season of The X-Files. It's this idea of kind of the outsider, or the vulnerable person, or the person who's been cast out or exploited, or even like not necessarily even exploited sinisterly by some outside force, but who's fallen upon bad times, has been abandoned by society, cast aside, and is trying to find a way to make sense of the world, if that makes sense. And there's something very tragic and very moving in that. And I think you're right about that. The performance is outstanding. I mean, I would agree with you that like Roland is not one of the best episodes of the first season. I know that Ivanek's performance can be divisive. I actually really liked Ivanek's performance in Roland. And I think he's great here. And I think that it's remarkable. He's notable as one of like the 10-13 guest stars who's gone on to kind of more prominent things in his later career as well, which is remarkable. He's one of those kind of TV supporting actors who came into his own when he reached like 40 or 50, despite, you know, jobbing relatively constantly since his late 20s. But there's something very affecting about the portrayal of Danny here, as you said, that, you know, because you're right, it is initially set up like he's operating in a sleazy sort of like bedsit, and you're right, he's had his license revoked probably, and he's doing illegal experiments, and he's part of this, he's like, he's catching people, and he's luring people who are vulnerable, and he's probably collecting a few dollars off the back end. But when you actually meet him and you get to know him, and you get to spend time with him, there's a real humanity to him.
Absolutely. Yeah. See, Johannesson just always impressed me with this series. Just always really, not only did he take a very outside and skewed look at this whole mythos, but he did so, I think, in ways that were extraordinarily sensitive and perceptive, in my estimation.
One of the things that I like about Danny, and I think that the show does rather well with Danny, is that it uses him, again, like you have the mirror image of the Proloft itself. You have anti-Proloft, or the evil twin, or the mirror image, or whatever. But you have Danny used as an expression of the fears of Frank. And these are fears that he doesn't articulate until the end of the episode. But this idea of, like, Danny wandering into the middle of the streets because he's following lights and he's convinced that it's the pathway to heaven, and worried that that he might have dragged his poor daughter along with him, and that she would be hurt or killed as a result of this. Something that, you know, that's a literal nightmare, but it expresses a deep-seated fear that I think, you know, talking to parents and people who are parents, and even my own family, I know is a concern when you have an illness like that, is that you're worried about passing something on to the next generation without it being their fault, or without anything, you know, just by virtue of being born, that they would be affected by this thing, just by virtue of being your kids, that they would be affected by this thing. And it's a very real fear. And I think the episode does that rather well, and kind of mirrors it back to Frank in a way that enriches Frank as well. And it adds that element of character or humanity that, and I think you're right, I would agree with you entirely, is missing in places from this first season.
One of the things about Millennium, it does have its shortcomings, you know, despite the fact that it was, you know, very well written, very well produced series, but it's also a bummer. You know what I mean? It's like, it's really a bummer. Max Fennig's story is also a bummer. I mean, you know, Max Fennig is a guy who's on antipsychotic medications, as Scully points out in Fallen Angel, and is also very brilliant and intelligent and technologically savvy, which is how he's allowed to, you know, worm his way into this job for a defense contractor. But his story becomes incidental in the, you know, the tragedy of Max Fennig becomes the triumph of Mulder and Scully in solving this case, and so on and so forth, and converting this influential government worker to their sort of point of view. You don't really get that with Millennium. I'm not sure what the takeaway here is that, I mean, this is a reality too. I mean, there are these horrible medical tests. I mean, I remember back sometime in the 80s and 90s, you'd always be hearing these commercials on major radio stations for this week only, you know, pharmaceutical trials, we need volunteers, you know, make big money and all this kind of stuff. And then we see those people in the lobby, in the waiting room, sort of sharing their pharmaceutical trial horror stories and so on. and they're all just very inured to it and numbed to the horror and tragedy of it all. But I think that, you know, I mean, Frank does solve the case. The bad guy is caught, you know, but what are we left with?
Actually been gained in a meaningful sense.
Yeah, like what have we won at the end of the day? We really haven't won anything. It's just in the overall struggle kind of just fell down another notch. And that's one of the challenges when you have a series that's about rushing towards the apocalypse. You know, I hate to keep bringing up other series, but I'm actually one of my great guilty pleasures is Supernatural, which originally had a lot of X-Files people involved in it. You know, Kim Manners being sort of the guiding force of it. Now, that series has been running forever. I think it's done over 300 series. Now, one of the reasons I like about it is that it's kind of just like comfort food. It's like it's got to be the absolute most repetitive series ever. I mean, they've brought on, you know, the apocalypse has brought on like, I don't know, a dozen times by this point in time. I mean, they've been to hell, and you know, it's like they've gone through like every cosmic theological crisis you can possibly imagine. And then they're always just back to drinking beers and chasing vampires and stuff. I mean, it's a ludicrous, absolutely ludicrous show, and it's just pure escapism. But it's interesting, like that's kind of like the successful way. I mean, so Millennium kind of limped to three seasons and then died. I mean, this show, which is, I mean, of course, it exists in a different television ecosystem, and all that kind of thing. But you know, I mean, you can't argue with 15 seasons. Yes. That's a pretty healthy run. So obviously, it's making somebody money. I think that you know, the fact that they've brought on the apocalypse more times than I can count, and the status quo is always restored. It almost seems to be the only way that you can successfully
do a story like this or a TV show like this, at least. Yeah.
And I know that Lance Henriksen really hated the Millennium episode of The X-Files, and you know, I kind of don't blame him. You know, there are a lot of mitigating factors backstage, behind the scenes, that sort of necessitated that, you know, that story. And a lot of it had to do with money. You know, it's like, okay, the apocalypse is shooting zombies in a cellar somewhere. Well, you know, that's all they could really afford at that point in time. So, I mean, you know, television is always going to be, you know, your ability to tell stories is always going to be lessened and controlled and influenced by so many factors that have nothing to do with
the story you want to tell.
But anyway, the point being is that I think that in this case, if Carter's attention wasn't so heavily divided in, you know, in practically inhuman ways at this point in time in his career, I think that it would have been nice to have somebody who could maybe have brought all these impulses that all these different writers had in this series together in some sort of overarching whole. And I think that, you know, yeah, as much as I like Johannesson's mysticism, I think his stories sort of exist in like this counter rotation. You know, they exist in a different orbit than the rest of the series. And it just gives a sense that there's not really anybody at the controls, that, you know, Carter just sort of sets up a premise and everybody sort of does this spin on it without really, you know, understanding where he's going or what he wants to actually say here. And, you know, Johannesson produced very interesting episodes. Jim Wong produced very interesting episodes. There are a number of very, very high quality episodes, Sacrament, Lamentation. I mean, all these kind of episodes, they're all very, very good, but I'm just not exactly sure if they're telling a story.
Yeah. I think that's a legitimate concern. I think that's something that's like, this is something that's not gone away. Like 10, you know, 20 years after Millennium ended, we're still trying to figure out what exactly, how things fit together. And I mean, like, you can see that with aspects of the mythology in inverted commas, but I think even in terms of, and again, I've described Millennium as, being three different shows sort of mashed together. Each of the three seasons is a different television show that just happens to feature some of the same characters, I would contend. Now, I know that there's some disagreement about that and how they all fit together and stuff like that, but I think that there is an element of truth to that to a certain extent. But actually, just while we're kind of wrapping up on Walkabout, is there anything else that you want to discuss? Anything else that we've missed? Because it is a fascinating episode, and it's very different from a lot of the ones around it.
I think that, my takeaway for Walkabout, aside from the fact that it had that interesting phenomenon of being sort of a, two peas in a pod with demons, sort of like a companion set piece to that episode. I mean, I do think that Demons is the more interesting and more narratively intense episode. It is fascinating to me that Demons uses those
elements,
the Frank flashes. It gives Mulder the Frank flashes, right? Which I think I find kind of interesting, and it's kind of interesting that Mulder gets we see those Millennium film techniques in his flashbacks, and how is that being induced? It's being induced through trepanation and ketamine. So it makes you kind of wonder where Frank got his originally. It's, there's an interesting implication, a very meta implication there that I think could make for some great fan theorizing. But it's a great episode, great performances. Definitely, I think, in the very upper tier of this season. And oddly enough, an episode that even back then, you didn't really hear people talk about. I think that Hanna-Sism's mysticism was a bit ahead of its time. Yeah. It sort of feeds into the kind of storytelling that we see in the binging and streaming era. Yeah, yeah, it's like you could imagine, like, if he was given control of Millennium,
it'd be more like the OA or Sense8.
Yeah, it's a Netflix kind of program that he would he would have taken it in a very interesting and unusual kind of direction. And I'm sorry that I didn't get to see that show as much, as much as I do enjoy Millennium on very many levels. But it's just, I think it's an episode that people should go back and watch, because in light of all the stories we're seeing in the news about the pharmaceuticals industry, and not, I always do this and I sound like an idiot and I hate to do it, but like, I'm literally right down the street from all the big companies' headquarters. I mean, New Jersey used to be called the medicine chest of the world, or medicine chest of America, I think. But it's like, I just heard that Johnson & Johnson and, Janssen, which is one of their subsidiaries. I mean, the like literally right down the street from here, in Bridgewater and so on. I mean, it's literally the next town over that you have all these huge, I mean, absolutely huge, industrial parks. And if you ever want to just go on Google Maps, you can kind of see it for yourself, because it's really stunning to see these things from the highway. So it's a very, interesting story that I have some sort of personal connection to, as well as that sort of geographical connection too. And I think, but it's a story that I think is incredibly relevant today. And I think that if you're aware of what's going on with the pharmaceutical industry and the news and so on and so forth, that it's definitely an episode you should watch.
I realize that, we've drifted on from that in the conversation, but I do love the term Frank flashes. the term Frank flashes, I feel like I never heard that before, actually, which is kind of strange. So I feel like we should patent that, because I feel like that's a keeper right there. You get
I just coined it, so.
It's like, I kind of love the idea of he's coming down with a case of the Frank flashes. I do think that there is something interesting. And again, we've been going on probably far too long at this point to get into it. So maybe we'll put a little marker in it and say to come back to it at some point when we're talking about the show in the future. I think you're entirely right about things like the use of stuff from Millennium in the X-Files. Cause it's kind of fascinating how a lot of stuff in like around about say season 4, season 5, season 6, but even later on from the X-Files seems to have imported over from Millennium almost wholesale, as if Millennium was kind of a testing ground for things and images and ideas that Carter wasn't yet sure what to do with. And I like that this is one example of that to a certain extent. We can see sort of parallel development with, like, you know, psychedelics, tray panning, this sort of weird memory flash, the possibility of something happened while our lead character was blacked out. And again, you can go back to stuff like the pilot and see things, see a lot of like the red and the black in there, and you know, other things like that that are very interesting as well. It's kind of interesting how they all exist together, kind of, you know, in terms of cannibalizing one another or just in terms of like shared ideas. And I find that absolutely fascinating. But anyway, I think that sort of wraps it up. But if people are looking for a bit more Chris in their lives, where can they find you?
Just come over to Twitter and look for The Secret Son Speaks. And anything that I'm writing somewhere else, I will link to. So
nice. So it's a centralized sort of database, which is cool. Centralized sort of place.
Yeah, it's sort of like, you know, it's my little bulletin board. I'm going back to the dial-up BBS days in spirit, you know, because I miss them so.
I mean, yeah, there was a sort of a vague innocence about those times. There was probably not an innocence about that time, but we just feel a little bit nostalgic now, I think, for them, in this era of Twitter and social media and shouting. Although I think, as you pointed out, a lot of the stuff that we now associate with Twitter and social media and Facebook and shouting can trace its roots back to the old, bulletin board days, I think.
Oh dear. Oh dear. Yeah. I will hear all these people say, oh my God, you know, all these, bullying and harassment and toxic this and toxic that. And it's like, it was pretty hairy, and it was a lot less regulated. There was nobody sort of, you know, there's no hall monitors in those days. It was really, it could get pretty brutal. So but by the same token, I got to say that, you know, when I first went online in the early 90s, it was those dopamine hits were near opioid level. It was amazing. It was an amazing feeling to just have the access to that world of information at your fingertips, you know.
Oh, the old dial-up sound. So what you're saying is don't pay attention to those Hans Ingrams of social media, is what we're getting the big takeaway.
It's always been a mess. So, you know, that's just people. You know, whenever people congregate, they're going to fight. So what are you going
to
do?
That's it. Put three people in a room and pretty soon two of them will be trying to kill the other one. So that's Grant. We're going to wrap up then. But remember, you can find the Time Is Now podcast online at the Time Is Now pod, which is our Twitter handle. You can also find us at the Yellow House on Facebook as well, home for discussion and debate around the show. We'll be back next week. But remember, this is who we are.
The Time Is Now, a Millennium podcast, was created by Tony Black, who co-produces alongside Kurt North. You can find the show on Twitter at The Time Is Now Pod, and on Facebook if you type in The Time Is Now. Plus, we have a Facebook fan group called The Yellow House, full of active Millennium discussion. The Time Is Now is also part of the We Made This podcast network at We Made This Pod, alongside a range of popular culture shows about TV, film, music, and beyond, including our sister show, The X-Cast, an X-Files podcast. For advance access to The Time Is Now and access to bonus material, consider supporting The X-Cast and We Made This on Patreon at patreon.com/TheXcast. That's patreon.com/TheXcast. You'll find a full range of subscription tiers available. Thanks for listening.